It was already day, a windless and sullen morning, and the marsh reeks lay in heavy banks. No sun pierced the low, clouded sky, and Gollum seemed anxious to continue the journey at once. So after a brief rest, they set out again, and were soon lost in a shadowy, silent world, cut off from all view of the lands about, either the hills that they had left or the mountains that they sought. They went slowly in single file, Gollum, Sam, Frodo. Frodo seemed the most weary of the three, and slow though they went, he often lagged. The hobbits soon found that what had looked like one vast fen was really an endless network of pools and soft mires and winding, half-strangled watercourses. Among these, a cunning eye and foot could thread a wandering path. Gollum certainly had that cunning, and needed all of it. His head on its long neck was ever turning this way and that, while he sniffed and muttered all the time to himself. Sometimes he would hold up his hand and halt them, while he went forward a little, crouching, testing the ground with fingers or toes, or merely listening with one ear pressed to the earth. It was dreary and wearisome. Cold, clammy winter still held sway in this forsaken country. The only green was the scum of livid weed on the dark, greasy surfaces of the sullen waters. Dead grasses and rotting reeds loomed up in the mists like ragged shadows of long-forgotten summers. As the day wore on, the light increased a little, and the mist lifted, growing thinner and more transparent. Far above the rot and vapors of the world, the sun was riding high and golden now, in a serene country with floors of dazzling foam, but only a passing ghost of her could they see below, bleared, pale, giving no color and no warmth. But even at this faint reminder of her presence, Gollum scowled and flinched. He halted their journey, and they rested, squatting like little hunted animals, in the borders of a great brown reed thicket. There was a deep silence, only scraped on its surfaces by the faint quiver of empty seed plumes, and broken grass blades trembling in small air movements that they could not feel.
Mmm, what a place.
Yeah. Sounds awful.
All right, Clifford. Well, we're back again for another episode.
Indeed we are. We've got chapter 2 of book 4, The Passage of the Marshes. I said that wrong. The Passage of the Marshes.
Okay. What do we think? How do we feel?
I think I feel good and bad. Good in that they made some good progress in this chapter on their journey to Mordor. Bad in that... This is more of the same, if not worse, than the quagmire they're stuck in the last chapter.
Yeah,
except
I feel...
where last chapter everything seemed like it was gray and sharp, now everything's brown and slimy.
Yeah, so for the past two chapters, I've been organizing the notes literally in the two-hour lead-up to when we recorded both times. So I feel like that should kind of give an indication that about how I feel with these chapters.
Okay.
Hopefully it'll get better. Not to say I didn't like it. It's just, man, this is depressing. Mm-hmm. Depressing work.
A heavy weight weighs on your shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so today we're going to talk a good amount about Gollum. We're going to talk about what Frodo and Sam think of the rest of the journey coming ahead. And obviously we have to talk about all these marshes and stuff. And... yeah, a couple other minor things go on. Like, there's some creepy things flying around. There's those faces in the water. Those are creepy. Yeah, we'll get to all of that. But before that, Cliff's notes.
A subdued and seemingly obedient Gollum leads Frodo and Sam out of the hills and into marshland below. Sam remains suspicious of Gollum, particularly when he overhears Gollum arguing with himself over a sleeping Frodo. However, Gollum holds the course, leading them through a nearly impossible route of land through the swamps. Nazgul and ghosts notwithstanding, the beleaguered trio makes it to the plains outside the walls of Mordor and steals themselves for the next leg of their journey.
All right, cool. Okay, so this is kind of fun. For all of Book 4, just keep this in mind. It's pretty easy to actually date all the writings of these because at this point it was 1944 and Christopher Tolkien was in the Air Force and he was stationed in South Africa. So J.R.R. Tolkien, he was sending him kind of manuscripts or typed scripts of these whole chapters for him to read. And you can see all this in the letters that they're exchanging back and forth with the scripts and stuff. So I don't know. It's kind of, that one's kind of fun to just keep in mind for basically, I think like all of Book 4, but we'll see. I'll probably note it some more as we go on. Also funny, this section of the book, like the last chapter, this chapter and the chapter after it, they were all originally just supposed to be one thing, but he wrote too much. Just started dragging on, you know, it's like, oh man. And it's pretty impressive. We already read the one in the opening, like his descriptions of just a really crappy area to be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he gets that across that this place sucks. This is a hard journey. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're only coming to the edge of it at the beginning of the chapter. And in the opening of it, there is a classic chant, rhyme, song that Gollum sings or puts together or does something. Anyways, I thought just as a fun opener, on a light note, Clifford and I would have a reading contest of it, and I think we have a certain other J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, rendition as well, so we'll see how we can compare. Well, I'm going to try to make this a regular thing. There's other passages in the future in Lord of the Rings that, like, yeah, we should have reading contests on it because they're awesome. This one was more just fun, but yeah. I'll let you go first.
Oh, maybe I'll let you go first. Okay, fine.
Did you plan out the outline?
The cold, hard lands, they bites our feet. Oh.
Clifford. Not to say I shouldn't laugh, because I'm going to screw up too, but...
The cold, hard lands, they bites our hands, they gnaws our feet. The rocks and stones are like old bones, all bare of meat. But stream and pool is wet and cool, so nice for feet. And now we wish... Ha! Ha, what does we wish? He said, looking sidelong at the hobbits. We'll tell you, he croaked. He guessed it long ago, Baggins guessed it. A glint came into his eyes, and Sam, catching the gleam in the darkness, thought it far from pleasant. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsting, ever drinking, clad in mail, never clinking, drowns on dry land, thinks as an island is a mountain, thinks a fountain is a puff of air, so sleek, so fair, what a joy to meet, we only wish to catch a fish so juicy sweet.
The cold hard lands, they bites our hands, they gnaw our feet, the rocks and stones are like old bones, all bare of meat, but stream and pool is wet and cool, so nice for feet, and now we wish... Ha ha, what does we wish? He said, looking sidelong at the hobbits. We'll tell you, he croaked. He guessed it long ago, Baggins guessed it. A glint came into his eyes, and Sam, catching the gleam in the darkness, thought it far from pleasant. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsting, ever drinking, clad in mail, never clinking. Drowns on land, thinks an island is a mountain, thinks a fountain is a puff of air, so sleek, so fair. What a joy to meet, we only wish to catch a fish so juicy sweet.
Nice.
I think we got Tolkien reading this, too.
Gollum chuckled to himself, sometimes even croaking in a sort of song. The cold, hard lands, they bites our hands, they gnaws our feet. The rocks and stones are like old bones, all bare of meat. But stream and pool is wet and cool, so nice for feet. And now we wish... Aha, what does we wish? He guessed it long ago. Baggins guessed it. Alive without breath, as cold as death, never thirsting, ever drinking, clad in mail, never clinking, drowns on dry land, thinks an island is a mountain, thinks a fountain is a puff of air, so sleek, so fair, what a joy to meet. We only wish to catch a fish so juicy, sweet.
Yeah, he went for the slower. I thought he did that one upbeat. Oh, I
guess he's good wrong. Though.
Yeah, he's
real good.
It's almost like he wrote it.
I feel like the voice of an old British man though is also just like automatically a good narrator.
Yeah, did you ever listen to? I know I clipped it in. He his one, he did like a half hour reading of the riddle section with Bilbo.
Mm-hmm. I think
that,
so.
That was really good. Somehow I don't think I've announced yet that anytime we've clipped this guy in, yes, this is J.R.R. Tolkien that's talking. I feel like maybe I just left that to be determined yourself. Yeah, but his one that he does for the Ents marching song is just so epic. So good. You can find all this on YouTube, too. Just look up J.R.R. Tolkien reads, and then there's a bunch for all the books. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he doesn't, you know, audiobook the whole thing, but lots of clips out there. All right, let's keep moving on, though. Let's get into this actual chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, well, so this song kind of brings up the question to Sam, what's Gollum going to eat? You know, because him and Frodo, they don't have much food to spare. And they stop at dawn, and Smeagol is afraid of the sun. Plus, he says there's orcs that have good sight, so it's best to hide anyways. And then, yeah, then there's an interesting section here. You want to take Frodo?
We must take a little food, said Frodo. Are you hungry, Smeagol? We have very little to share, but we will spare you what we can.
At the word hungry, the greenish light was kindled in Gollum's pale eyes, and they seemed to protrude further than ever from his thin, sickly face. For a moment he relapsed into the old Gollum manner. We are famished. Yes, famished we are, precious, he said. What is it that they eat? Have they nice fishes? His tongue lolled out between his sharp yellow teeth, licking his colorless lips.
No, we have got no fish, said Frodo. We have only got this. He held up a wafer of lembas. And water, if there is water here that is fit to drink.
Yes, yes, nice water, said Gollum. Drink it, while we can. But what is it they've got, precious? Is it crunchable? Is it tasty?
Frodo broke off a portion of a wafer and handed it to him on its leaf wrapping. Gollum sniffed at the leaf and his face changed. A spasm of disgust came over it, and a hint of his old malice.
Smeagol smells it, he said. Leaves out of the elf country. Gah, they stink. He climbed in those trees, and he couldn't wash the smell off his hands. Nice hands.
Dropping the leaf, he took a corner of the lembas and nibbled it. He spat, and a fit of coughing shook him.
Ah, no, he spluttered. You tried to choke poor Smeagol. Dust and ashes. He can't eat it. He must starve. But Smeagol doesn't mind. Nice hobbits. Smeagol has promised. He will starve. He can't eat hobbit's food. He will starve. Poor thin Smeagol.
I'm sorry, said Frodo, but I can't help you, I'm afraid. I think this food would do you good if you would try. But perhaps you can't even try. Not yet, anyway.
All right, thoughts.
Well, one, I don't know if it's just because I've seen the movie and everything and read this before, but the quotes from Gollum, I think, are so well done. They convey his personality struggles, and I don't know.
That's what I thought too. I was like, man, how did Tolkien write this? You know?
Yeah, it's just like so. It brings up like such distinctive imagery and stuff. Like you can see the two sides of his mind wrestling with everything at all times.
Yeah.
And then also like the I guess it, when he's being his like pathetic like pity me pathetic self.
Yeah.
You know, reiterating like, oh, I'll starve. Don't worry about me. Yeah. I'll serve you and I'll starve. And you can feel like how frustrating and like, you know, that's not the full story. And he's being deliberately like pitiful.
Well, you know, but there is like an aspect where he is kind of trying to just be the team player a little bit.
Right. And I felt, I don't know. Yeah. Something about it. It just comes through. So that part stands out to me as just like the Gollum quotes are so well done.
Yeah.
But in general, I don't know. It does. It's like one of the practical parts of the story that we don't touch on very often. You know, like we never really heard about Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli eating.
No, we did. They ate the lembas.
Oh, right. Okay.
I pointed that out
on their three day run.
And then they got with Rohan and they had normal food.
Right. You know? Right.
They said they had provisions and stuff.
But yeah. Anyways, this reminds us that these guys are backpacking through the wilderness and they've got to survive somehow. Which makes us wonder, how are things going to go down going forward? And what's Gollum up to? And what's he been eating if he can't eat this?
Yeah, well, what's the obvious? To state the obvious, he can't eat the lembas bread.
Right.
What's significant about that besides that he doesn't have a source of energy?
Well, a few things. One is that clearly there's something about the elf stuff that just totally burns him. Just like the rope, the cloak, anything it seems like that elves have touched or made is just like acid to him. And then also the implication is the only other thing around here besides grass and mud are hobbits.
Yeah, right. Well, so specifically though with the Lembas, I mean, of all the elves things, you know, the rope, the cloaks,
mm-hmm.
this is probably the biggest deal because we were saying this is one of the most obvious signs you're going to get of basically a pretty easy sign of the Eucharist in Lord mm-hmm. of the Rings, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very significant that Gollum can't even endure that because the Eucharist is supposed to be the body of Christ. And so if you can't handle that, that's
right.
probably very problematic. You know?
Right.
That potentially that means you're in a state of like maybe mortal sin or you... It has to imply that there's some sort of evilness about you that you can't handle something so good, right?
Right, absolutely.
which is true of like all the elven equipment, but most especially true of the Lembas here.
Mm-hmm.
But Frodo, there is like some little bit of hope there where he says, I think this would be good for you, but perhaps you're not ready to try yet.
Right, right.
So maybe if we keep working with you, at some point you're going to be ready to have this and you'll, I don't know, obviously.
Yeah, between the last chapter and now, Frodo has sort of set the stage or is envisioning some sort of redemption for Gollum, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Frodo's going to speak to him respectfully. He's going to call him Sméagol and he's going to, I don't know, revive the old Sméagol out of the evil Gollum.
Yeah. Well, that's the hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
As they go on here, though, so first of all, it's just funny to note the way Gollum watches him eat. Tolkien compares him to a dog, you know, like watching, turning his head constantly to see
mm-hmm.
food to, from hand to mouth, you know.
Right.
But then, you know, Frodo. It's weird because for the next couple scenes, in the next one, they sit down and rest, and Sam says he'll stay awake for the next watch because. He doesn't really trust either Gollum or his other identity, Sméagol. He's mm-hmm. not convinced either personality's permanently changed to be good, right? And Frodo seems to... He always just keeps implying, like, well, we could probably trust him for now. The promise will hold for now, which is... I don't know where Frodo's getting that idea from, but... Or you know, the obvious implication is, well, how long is for now, you know?
Right, right. I mean, that alone is pretty interesting, and it kind of is actually totally contradicts what we were just saying about Frodo saying maybe you can't handle the Lembas yet.
Right.
And Frodo expects a certain amount of redemption for Gollum. At the same time, it seems like he's anticipating Gollum struggling more and more as they get closer to Mordor, perhaps.
Yeah, potentially.
So those are two totally different visions of the future.
Yeah, crossing trajectories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, but for the first scene, Frodo and Gollum do fall asleep, and Sam makes sure Gollum falls asleep. And at that point, he's low-key kind of tempted to just kill Gollum in his sleep right away.
Right.
And just have end the nuisance.
I mean, he walks over to him, and he's like, he kind of whispers and claps in front of his face to see if he's sleeping. And then he's like, well, I could just, you know.
Right, right.
I could just strangle him right now.
Yeah, yeah. But Sam himself falls asleep, and then when he wakes up, Frodo's still asleep, and Gollum, he finds Gollum surprisingly just behaving like normal. There's nothing treacherous going on,
mm-hmm.
and he actually kind of kept guard for them while he was asleep. So there is mm-hmm. some sort of change going on in Gollum, but how hopeful or how long is that going to last?
Right.
So, moving on, though, they get into what's kind of a brief conversation, but pretty powerful. Packs a little bit of a punch, so long as you didn't actually just read through it and just miss it completely. How about I take Sam? About the food, said Sam. How long is it going to take us to do this job? And when it's done, what are we going to do then? This whey bread keeps you on your legs in a wonderful way, though it doesn't satisfy the innards proper, as you might say. Not to my feeling, anyhow. Meaning no disrespect to them as made it. But you have to eat some of it every day, and it doesn't grow. I reckon we've got enough to last, say, 3 weeks or so, and that's with a tight belt and a light tooth, mind you. We've been a bit free with it so far.
I don't know how long we shall take to finish, said Frodo. We were miserably delayed in the hills. But Samwise Gamgee, my dear hobbit, indeed, Sam, my dearest hobbit, friend of friends, I do not think we need give thought to what comes after that. To do the job, as you put it, what hope is there that we ever shall? If we do, who knows what will come of that? If the one goes into the fire, and we are at hand? I ask you, Sam, are we ever likely to need bread again? I think not. If we can nurse our limbs to bring us to Mount Doom, that is all we can do. More than I can, I began to feel.
Sam nodded silently. He took his master's hand and bent over it. He did not kiss it, though his tears fell on it. Then he turned away, drew his sleeve over his nose, and got up and stamped about, trying to whistle. So, that's a big deal. What did Frodo say? Mm-hmm. Just to sum it up.
We're going to the end, and probably we're going down with the boat on this one.
If we even make it there.
Right.
Yeah.
You could interpret it a lot of different ways. One is like, if we make it there and destroy this thing, it's probably the end of the world as we know it, so there's no saying what happens after that. Or if we're taking this thing all the way, we're probably going to be destroyed when we destroy the ring because we'll be at the scene. Or This is such a big deal that there's no point even thinking about what comes next, because even if it's good news, we can't project anything past this monumentous point.
Yeah, and so what do you think about Sam here? Because, I mean, this does kind of hit him like a rock if it hasn't ever before. But mm-hmm. I feel like it kind of had.
Sam is super committed. I mean,
he's crying. Yeah, he's crying now. You know?
He's super committed, as we've seen before. He's amazingly loyal to Frodo. But he's always been really pragmatic. You know, he wants to chart out how much food they have and how many days of walking and all that. Yeah. And he's always thinking about the Shire and his past life. So that, to me, that means a few things. One is that he's just pragmatic and like fully intends to just walk back home after they complete this thing and can't envision a world where he doesn't go back to the Shire.
Or this is the first time he is now.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the same time, he's so committed to Frodo that he's all in for whatever Frodo says, including this. And probably he's already processed it before, but he might be crying not for his own life, but for Frodo's. He wants to protect Frodo as best he can. And when Frodo's acknowledging, like, I'm going down with the ring, Sam probably understands that he's right, but is sad that he can't offer an alternative or something.
Well, what do we think about the trying to whistle at the end? Sam tries to whistle.
Distract himself.
Is it kind of, well, distract, or is it like, you know, yeah, I guess it's kind of distract, but it's more
keep himself upbeat.
Yeah, upbeat, stay positive, keep mm-hmm. going, mm-hmm. trudge Definitely. Through. You know, this is the kind of Hobbit courage stuff that we've talked about multiple mm-hmm. times already. This happens later in the chapter, but I think it fits better here after this brutal realization. But they're not quite in the marshes yet, in the part that we just read, but if we want to skip to part of that where they're walking through, do you want to go to page 616?
Frodo seemed to be weary to the point of exhaustion. He said nothing, indeed he hardly spoke at all, and he did not complain, but he walked like one who carries a load, the weight of which is ever increasing, and he dragged along slower and slower, so that Sam had often to beg Gollum to wait and not to leave their master behind. In fact, with every step towards the gates of Mordor, Frodo felt the ring on its chain about his neck grow more burdensome. He was now beginning to feel it as an actual weight dragging him earthwards. But far more, he was troubled by the eye, so he called it to himself. It was that more than the drag of the ring that made him cower and stoop as he walked. The eye, that horrible growing sense of a hostile will that strove with great power to pierce all shadows of cloud and earth and flesh, and to see you, to pin you under its deadly gaze, naked, immovable. So thin, so frail and thin, the veils were become that still warded it off. Frodo knew just where the present habitation and heart of that will now was, as certainly as a man can tell the direction of the sun with his eyes shut. He was facing it, and its potency beat upon its brow. Gollum probably felt something of the same sort, but what went on in his wretched heart between the pressure of the eye and the lust of the ring that was so near, and his groveling promise made half in the fear of cold iron, the hobbits did not guess. Frodo gave no thought to it. Sam's mind was mostly occupied with his master, hardly noticing the dark cloud that had fallen on his own heart. He put Frodo in front of him now, and kept a watchful eye on every movement of his, supporting him if he stumbled, and trying to encourage him with clumsy words.
Okay, so this switches gears a little bit, but because now we're seeing how the rings, we're getting a real example of how Frodo's dealing with the ring here, but it also does still touch on Sam and even Gollum a little bit. But yeah, what do you think of that?
That whole passage feels to me like, I mean, I know they said gravity. Frodo's now feeling the gravity of the ring literally pulling on him, but also in the sense, I feel like everything's heavy. Like, everyone's weighed down by different things.
Right.
They're moving through this really slow landscape where the fact that they're weighed down makes them even slower. But then there's also this gravity-like attraction, like, between planets or something. They're all drawn to each other in different ways. They're, you know, I think of them as, like, three things kind of orbiting each other. But they're also in the larger pull of this bigger thing that they're going towards.
Mm.
And yeah, it's like it's not elegant or anything, so I wouldn't say it's like a dance, but they're all circling each other, trying to help, trying to get something, and all being pulled in one direction at the same time.
That they're in orbit of something else, I think I agree with. I don't know if they're each orbiting each other.
No, I mean not in a symmetrical way or anything. Just like, yeah. Like specifically Gollum is being pulled towards Mordor. He hates Mordor, wants to run away. He's got this tension in himself, but then he also wants the ring, and he took an oath, so he's pulled so many directions at once. And then yeah. Frodo's just being like dragged down, but also dragged closer to the ring, to Mordor by the eye. Sam is like following Frodo, trying to help him, being pulled as a result, trying to keep an eye on Gollum. It's like a, yeah, I don't know how else to describe it. It's like they're all tied together inextricably. You couldn't pull one of them apart without breaking it.
Yeah.
And they're all hurtling towards the center of all the bad things.
Right. So another image for everybody, and maybe you've already been picking this up with Frodo since they've set out from either the Shire or from Rivendell, and this should hopefully start to become very clear for the rest of this book of Lord of the Rings. This weight of carrying the ring sounds a lot like Christ carrying the cross, you know, stations of the cross, kind of thing. Like once he's actually condemned to die on the cross, then he has to go walk to the place by carrying it, you know. And Joseph Pierce points out in one of his books, he says in this pretty cool quote here, then again, this is exactly the reasons you read some of these supplementary texts for quotes like this. Such is the potency of the prose in the nature of Tolkien's mysticism that the parable of Frodo's burden may even lead the reader to a greater understanding of Christ's burden. All of a sudden, one sees that it is not so much the weight of the cross that caused Christ to stumble, but the weight of evil, symbolized by Tolkien as the eye of Sauron. You know, because that's what they're referring to when he's like carrying the ring, he's seeing the eye this whole time and stuff, and it's like, oh, yeah, Tolkien's almost giving us insight into maybe what it felt like for Jesus on Good Friday as he was walking to Calvary. We're in the Dead Marshes, and we're getting closer to Mordor, so that's going to intensify the closer we get to basically Mount Doom, you know? So,
okay.
Interesting. Yeah. He also points out, too, you know, and this kind of goes back to what you're saying with, like, people revolving around each other here. Frodo, he's going, carrying this, doing all this, but Sam's also a hero here because he's the servant of Frodo here. What were the lines about Sam? It said, Sam's mind was already mostly occupied with his master, hardly noticing the dark cloud that had fallen on his own heart. He put Frodo in front of him and kept a very watchful eye, you know? All right, we're starting to see Sam, selfless, awesome servant, though we've already been seeing that, too.
This is the first time we've heard of, I mean, he's always been helpful, but extremely upbeat and pragmatic. And so this is the first time that he's having any sort of internal struggle, it seems like.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And not just struggling on behalf of Frodo.
Right. All right, we got to describe these actual marshes, though.
Okay,
so why don't we start off just, we can't read all the descriptions of this whole chapter, but it's just shocking how many he can come up with, and they're all, all pretty much pack a punch. But why don't we read that, one on 611 there?
On either side and in front, wide fens and mires now lay, stretching away southward and eastward into the dim half-light. Mists curled and smoked from dark and noisome pools. The reek of them hung stifling in the still air. Far away, now almost due south, The mountain walls of Mordor loomed, like a black bar of rugged clouds floating above a dangerous, fog-bound sea. The hobbits were now wholly in the hands of Gollum. They did not know, and could not guess in that misty light, that they were in fact only just within the northern borders of the marshes, the main expanse of which lay south of them. They could, if they had known the lands, with some delay have retraced their steps a little, and then turning east, have come round over hard roads to the bare plain of Daggerlad, the field of the ancient battle before the gates of Mordor. Not that there was great hope in such a course. On that stony plain there was no cover, and across it ran the highways of the orcs and the soldiers of the enemy. Not even the cloaks of Lorien would have concealed them there.
Okay. So that's pretty cool. So, yeah, if you look at maps, a really good detailed map somewhere, you'll see that they're kind of, like it's saying here, they're crossing a little stretch of it. Like, they don't have to go through the whole middle of it. But then, more importantly, what they're saying, this is right near the site of the Daggerlad battle, and this is the famous one that the Last Alliance fought when they defeated Sauron the first time. That was with Isildur and his dad, Elendil, and then Gil-galad for the elves, with Elrond's help as well. Mm-hmm. And so they had fought the battle basically here, and that led to them then, I think, getting access to Mordor. Maybe they had to siege the Black Gates first. And then they definitely had to siege Barad-dûr itself. But this battle was the one that kind of broke the camel's back, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's some maps at the end of my book for reference. I don't know if you have the same ones, but there's a handful that are pretty useful. Capture this stuff in good detail.
Yeah.
The second to the last one for me is, I think, the best one. It shows Rohan and Gondor and Mordor all zoomed up pretty close, but... I mean, you got from the description, they're between a rock and a hard place, what yeah. It sounds like.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's a few things going on. They're pretty much lost, and they're shrouded in fog, so they don't actually know where they are. Gollum kind of knows where they are, but they're completely beholden to Gollum, in whichever way he says. If they were to figure out where they're going, they would know that they had some alternative options, but they weren't really good options.
Right. It's also just funny note, too. Remember the Council of Elrond, how they're going through the whole history of the ring and stuff, and the most recent history was Aragorn had captured Gollum. It was probably here in the Dead Marshes. So Aragorn's been here before, a couple years before, when Gollum was wandering around, probably finding his way through, and Aragorn captured him. Which,
okay.
Interesting to think about. Interesting to think Aragorn tracked him to this spot, you know, or whatnot, or, you know, yeah, those two had interactions here, basically, kind of weird. Let's see, though. So Gollum says he knows the way through the marshes, which obviously, like we said, little traffic goes through here. Rest of the paths are being watched heavily. I think this is kind of where the description we read at the beginning comes in. So as we said, they start hiking with Gollum, Sam, Frodo. Frodo's lagging behind the whole time. Gollum's then starting to have trouble finding the proper route. I feel like the exact route must change. You know, there's not just one way through this, like these bogs and stuff. Like, there's movement between that, right?
You know? Yeah, totally. I mean, I've done much trekking through marshes, but any sort of like wetland swamp thing you've ever been in, you can kind of envision what they're talking about. Like, the little like hummocks or tussocks of little like grass patches that are kind of like little island stepping stones throughout like a larger swamp thing. And sometimes they're good and hard and you can walk across them, but sometimes they're just grass and there's just sopping mud when you step there.
Yeah.
That's what I was envisioning for this. And like, yeah, undoubtedly there's probably like 100 different ways to go every single mile that they travel. But if you're smart or a good enough course guide like Gollum is, you can kind of sniff out the right way to go.
Yeah, they would put us all to shame because we all need GPSs now.
Yeah, exactly.
As we've talked about in other chapters before. All right, then we come to one of the pretty iconic creepy scene. So let's dive into this one.
Presently, it grew altogether dark. The air itself seemed black and heavy to breathe. When lights appeared, Sam rubbed his eyes. He thought his head was going queer. He first saw one with the corner of his left eye, a wisp of pale sheen that faded away. But others appeared soon after, some like dimly shining smoke, some like misty flames flickering slowly above unseen candles. Here and there they twisted like ghostly sheets unfurled by hidden hands, but neither of his companions spoke a word.
At last Sam could bear it no longer. "What's all this, Gollum?" he said in a whisper. "These lights, they're all around us now. Are we trapped? Who are they?"
Gollum looked up. A dark water was before him, and he was crawling on the ground, this way and that, doubtful of the way. "Yes, they are all around us," he whispered. "The tricksy lights. Candles of corpses. Yes, yes. Don't you heed them. Don't look. Don't follow them. Where's the master?"
Sam looked back and found that Frodo had lagged again. He could not see him. He went back some paces into the darkness, not daring to move far, or to call in more than a hoarse whisper. Suddenly he stumbled against Frodo, who was standing lost in thought, looking at the pale lights. His hand hung stiff at his sides. Water and slime were dripping from him. "Come, Mr. Frodo," said Sam. "Don't look at them. Gollum says we mustn't. Let's keep up with them and get out of the cursed place as quick as we can, if we can."
"All right," said Frodo, as if returning out of a dream. "I'm coming. Go on."
Hurrying forward again, Sam tripped, catching his foot in some old root or tussock. He fell and came heavily on his hands, which sank deep into the stinking ooze, so that his face was brought close to the surface of the dark mirror. There was a faint hiss. A noisome smell went up. The lights flickered and danced and swirled. For a moment, the water below him looked like some window, glazed with grimy glass, through which he was peering. Wrenching his hands out of the bog, he sprang back with a cry. "There are dead things, dead faces in the water," he said with a horror. "Dead faces!"
Gollum laughed. "The Dead Marshes, yes, yes, that is their name," he cackled. "You should not look in when the candles are lit."
"Who are they? What are they?" asked Sam, shuddering, turning to Frodo, who is now behind him.
"I don't know," said Frodo, in a dreamlike voice, "but I've seen them too, in the pools when the candles were lit. They lie in all the pools, pale faces, deep, deep under dark water. I saw them, grim faces and evil, and noble faces and sad. Many faces, proud and fair, and in weeds in their silver hair. But all foul, all rotting, all dead, a fell light is in them." Frodo hid his eyes in his hands. "I know not who they are, but I thought I saw there men and elves, and orcs beside them." "Yes, yes," said Gollum, "all dead, all rotten, elves and men and orcs, the Dead Marshes. There was a great battle long ago. Yes, so they told him when Sméagol was young. When I was young before the Precious came, it was a great battle, tall men with long swords, and terrible elves, and orcs is shrieking. They fought on the plain for days and months at the Black Gates. But the marshes have grown since then, swallowed up graves, always creeping, creeping."
All right, so that's super creepy. So it kind of, I don't think it said it, but since Frodo was wet and slime was dripping from him, I think Frodo fell in and we just didn't know. Like, it didn't say.
Good point, good point.
And then Sam falls in and kind of sees the faces. And the movie does this, the movie has a scene like this, and it's not too far off from that.
This also reminds me, it's not quite the same, but it reminds me of from the very beginning of Fellowship of the Ring when they set out from the Shire before they meet Tom Bombadil. The Barrow Whites.
Oh, that's after meeting Bombadil.
Sorry, okay, after Bombadil. When they meet the Barrow Whites, it's a similar thing, right? They're going
It's about as creepy as that, yeah.
They're going through like an ancient grave burial site of some sort.
Right, right.
And they get just sucked into it.
All right, well, so before stating the obvious, it's kind of interesting that he's got a creepy version of kind of desertification going on. You know, like how the Sahara's moving further down, you know, like how the desert's growing. Well, the dead marshes are growing here, and apparently it's moved on to where the battle was now. And so it's taking these people's graves in with it, and now they're, you know, they're sticking out with these creepy lights above them. But obviously the whole trench thing, all of this, what life experience of Tolkien's probably had to have inspired this?
World War I,
right? The trenches in there, right?
Yeah And I mean, you think of any photos you've seen of World War I trench warfare, not just the trenches but the mud,
yeah,
totally soggy battlefields that's just like was once a farm field, but has been turned into not quite a swamp, but something just pretty awful. And I'm sure that Tolkien's thinking of that type of thing as much as he is thinking about any natural swamp.
Well, and yeah, in those, in between the trenches and the mud puddles, there was probably dead bodies at some points, you know, as you're going through it. Shippy has this really good quote, you know, because they're seeing all these candles and the faces, and it's mesmerizing to them. But even it seems like Gollum's even failed to reach them and stuff. And Sam almost doesn't even kind of believe that the people are in there, is what was a little bit implied. But Shippy's got this really great quote. It's kind of long, but I want to read it.
about, you know, what do these faces mean that they're seeing?
As a brief distraction, if you Google search something along the lines of World War One mud, I feel like you get there's a lot of photos that convey something akin to what we're talking about.
All right, here goes. What do these faces mean? The ominous thing about them is that they are all, now, the same. They seem to represent the casualties of both sides, the servants of Sauron, grim faces and evil, the elves and men who opposed and defeated him, noble faces and sad. But it has all come to the same thing in the end. The whole sequence has reminded many people of First World War battlefields. Tolkien was on the Somme for 3 months, where the static warfare left the dead unburied for years, with both sides inextricably confused. This might account for the fact, the unsurprising fact, that the bodies of both sides corrupt in the same way. They all end up rotting and dead. But in Frodo's vision, even the noble faces are sad, and they are all not just rotting, but foul. They all have a fell light in them. There are several unvoiced implications, that the whole thing has been for nothing, a thought never too far from the living character's sense of ultimate defeat. That Sauron, though defeated in battle, has somehow managed to take his revenge on the dead, and now holds them in his grip. Perhaps worst of all, that all the dead are hostile to the living, that they have learned something in death that they could not know alive. As said before, there are hints in the Barrow-White chapter. Oh, look at you already referencing this. As said before, there are hints in the Barrow-White chapter that the White still controlled the dead buried in the Barrow. May even himself be one of the dead, one of those who fought the Witch King of Angmar, now turned to evil by some sort of psychic decomposition. A fear like this is powerfully expressed by the Unman in C.S. Lewis's Perelandra. The Unman, who is Weston, the scientist, taken on by a diabolical possession. But the awful thing there is that Weston's own psyche seems to still be alive underneath the possession and screaming for help, terrified that he is going to sink down to what he sees as the inevitable fate of all who die. The conception is a classical and heathen one, going back to Homer, and Tolkien and Lewis and all the Inklings no doubt vehemently rejected it, but they did not forget. Could it be true? Sam, in fact, suggests that this is some devilry hatched by the Dark Land, an illusion, ascending, intended to do just what it does, to cause fear and demoralization, and that is a comforting answer. The right thing to do is what the hobbits do, press on regardless. I don't know if there's much to say past that, but...
Mm-hmm. No, that was a very good quote, and I don't think I can say any of it better than the way he phrased it. But
right.
That whole aspect of seeing the dead here together, like, totally undermines any sense of glory, higher purpose. Like, it's super cynical, right?
Right, right.
Which I'm sure is just like we were saying, like Tolkien on a battlefield. You probably like you just doesn't matter what else is going on. You just see bodies, like bodies in the mud. What are you even fighting for? Just more bodies in the mud, you know?
Yeah, it's demoralizing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But as they realize, though, that isn't quite true, and they just have to keep pressing on, you know? Like, they just have to ignore it and go on. Like, even Gollum saying, don't just ignore the lights, just come on, you know? And if Gollum's saying that, then...
Right.
That's pretty impactful.
It does make you wonder, like, we've talked about, like, how evil, like, different visions... How'd you describe it? The different like worldviews of evil, the Manichaean versus what's the other one?
Boethius.
Boethian.
That's the absence of Boethius is the absence of good. Manichaean is like dualism thing.
Right, right. I guess it makes you maybe it's just it fits into that, but this whole thing with the dead being like pretty creepy ghosts definitely it adds a whole nother dimension to like the larger good versus evil thing that's been set up in the book so far.
Yeah, for sure. So it turns out that was the worst section, thankfully, because that was, that does end up being pretty damn bad. Mm-hmm. And there's still are some bad parts that we gotta read. But anyways, at this point, now they're starting to see the Nazgul fly over from Mordor. You know, we've gotten accustomed to that because there was the one that flew over their camp at night when Pippin looked at the Palantir. Like outside of Isengard. But anyways, for these guys, I think this is the first one that they're seeing here, and that must have been a scary sight. Besides that, Legolas had shot the one on the river, but this is the first time they're seeing it. And it also does like a little swirl past and flies over him again. And Gollum's extremely freaked out. Mm-hmm. He's the most freaked out of them, and it seems like he kind of holds like a fetal position for hours.
In this case, does it seem to you like the Nazgul saw them? I feel like the implication is that they easily could have been seen.
No, because the Nazgul can't see.
Oh, okay.
Their beasts can, and they can feel the ring. So maybe they felt something, so they went to check it out. But they also have a mission from Sauron himself. Because if you line this up, we're not going to do it, but just so that you're aware, you can line up these Nazgul appearances that are in this chapter. If you look at the days, you can line up which ones of these are the ones that are flying over Rohan to go to Isengard, because these are the same ones. You know, like, Tolkien does, you know, that's the good part, is he made, like, the map here. He made an extremely tight chronology of days for this book as these, you know, these different timelines are going along. So mm-hmm. when a Nazgul flies up from Mordor, probably a day or so later, maybe a little bit more, he's going to get to Isengard where our other characters are hanging out, you know, and it's going to fly over him at night. And then, you know, Pippin looks in the Palantir, so Sauron's immediately going to send another one to him too. I don't want to take the time tonight to figure out the chronology of that, but you you can line these up. Yeah, and I think Appendix B is just like the timeline of everything, so that one would probably help you out most. I think Shippy goes over it too, but again, we don't have to go through it.
At last, on the fifth morning since they took the road with Gollum, they halted once more. Before them, dark in the dawn, the great mountains reached up to roofs of smoke and cloud. Out of their feet were flung huge buttresses and broken hills that were now at the nearest scarce a dozen miles away. Frodo looked round in horror, dreadful as the dead marshes had been, and the arid moors of the Norman lands. More loathsome far was the country that the crawling day now slowly unveiled to his shrinking eyes. Even to the mirror of dead faces, some haggard phantom of green spring would come. But here, neither spring nor summer would ever come again. Here nothing lived, not even the leprous growths that feed on rottenness. The gasping pools were choked with ash and crawling muds, sickly white and gray, as if the mountains had vomited the filth of their entrails upon the land about. High mounds of crushed and powdered rock, great cones of earth, fire-blasted and poison-stained, stood like an obscene graveyard in endless rows, slowly revealed in the reluctant light. They had come to the desolation that lay before Mordor, the lasting monument to the dark labor of its slaves that should endure when all their purposes were made void, a land defiled, diseased beyond all healing, unless the great sea should enter in and wash it with oblivion. "I feel sick," said Sam. Frodo did not speak.
All right, so yeah, just another description where he's bringing it of this horrible land, you know. Mm-hmm. So I mean, they're getting out of the marshes.
Yeah, it's, I feel like a little bit of a matter of opinion there. If the marshes are like everything evil and rotten and disgusting, this is like completely lifeless, like a desert. And he describes it in a way where it sounds worse,
right?
Where he's like, at least something was alive in the marshes, even if it was rotten.
Right.
I feel like some people would be like, oh, I would take the I would take the lifeless desert over the slime. But
well, I mean, the next thing though is basically they try to sit and rest, and then all of a sudden foul fumes come and start choking them, and they just have to keep moving on because, like, I mean, we can't even sit here and breathe, you know?
Right. Just, this sounds like, to me,
this journey sucks.
Desert conjures up beautiful imagery of the wrong sort here. So I'm thinking this is more like, I'm thinking like salt flats mixed with like a volcanic landscape.
Yeah,
and
this, like, sounds like Melkor Morgoth's fortress in Angband. You know, this sounds like a very miniature version of that, because he had, that was basically a couple slag heap kind of volcano things.
Right,
just like this. Yeah,
slag heap. That's a good description.
Yeah. Okay. So, anyways, they sit down for the night. Sam sleeps and Frodo's on watch. And then this is, I think, this will be the last big chunk of the chapter that we're going to read. So why don't we jump in here? Look at that. I said 618 white space, and there's two white spaces. Which one was I talking about? All right. Anyways, they have both fallen asleep. So I think we're just going to start with the other one, the second one.
Suddenly, Sam woke up thinking that he heard his master calling. Sorry.
Oh, we're going to divide into the two golems here. We're each going to take one.
Okay. Which one are you going to be?
I'll be whatever the first one is.
Okay. Suddenly, Sam woke up, thinking that he heard his master calling. It was evening. Frodo could not have called, for he had fallen asleep and had slid down nearly to the bottom of the pit. Gollum was by him. For a moment, Sam thought that he was trying to rouse Frodo. Then he saw that it was not so. Gollum was talking to himself. Sméagol was holding a debate with some other thought that used the same voice but made it squeak and hiss. A pale light and a green light alternated in his eyes as he spoke.
"Sméagol promised," said the first thought.
"Yes, yes, my precious," came the answer. "We promised to save our precious, not to let him have it, never. But it's going to him, yes, nearer every step. What's the hobbit going to do with it, we wonders, yes, we wonders."
"I don't know. I can't help it. Master's got it. Sméagol promised to help the master."
"Yes, yes, to help the master of the precious. But if we was the master, then we could help ourselves, yes, and still keep promises."
"But Sméagol said he would be very, very good. Nice hobbit. He took cruel rope off Smeagol's leg. He speaks nicely to me."
"Very, very good, eh, my precious? Let's be good, good as fish, sweet one, but to ourselves. Not hurt the nice hobbit, of course. No, no."
"But the precious holds the promise," the voice of Sméagol objected.
"Then take it," said the other, "and let's hold it ourselves. Then we shall be master, Gollum. Make the other hobbit, the nasty, suspicious hobbit, make him crawl, yes, Gollum."
"But not the nice hobbit."
"Oh, no, not if it doesn't please us. He's still a Baggins, my precious, yes, a Baggins. A Baggins stole it. He found it and he said, nothing, nothing. We hate Bagginses."
"No, not this Baggins."
"Yes, every Baggin. All peoples that keep the precious. We must have it."
"But he'll see. He'll know. He'll take it from us."
"He sees. He knows. He heard us make silly promises. Against his orders. Yes. Must take it. The wraiths are searching. Must take it."
"Not for him."
"No, sweet one. See, my precious, if we has it, then we can escape. Even from him, eh? Perhaps we grows very strong. Stronger than wraiths. Lord Sméagol, Gollum the Great, the Gollum. Eat fish every day, 3 times a day, fresh from the sea. Most precious Gollum must have it. He wants it, we wants it, we wants it."
"But there's two of them. They'll wake too quick and kill us," whined Sméagol in the last effort. "Not now, not yet."
"We wants it, but..." And here was there was a long pause, as if a new thought had wakened. "Not yet, eh? Perhaps not. She might help. She might, yes."
"No, no, not that way," wailed Sméagol.
"Yes, we wants it, we wants it." Each time that the second thought spoke, Gollum's long hand crept out slowly, pawing towards Frodo, and then was drawn back with a jerk as Sméagol spoke again. Finally, both arms, with long fingers flexed and twitching, clawed towards his neck.
Okay, so Sam was listening in to that whole conversation, and obviously he was completely freaked out, as he rightly should be. Yeah, so, I mean, that's
Gollum probably... showed his cards.
Right, much. I mean, that's grade A, like, you know, whatever Gollum's wrestling with, this is mm-hmm. prime case study material.
Mm-hmm. We know what the dilemma is. There's some questions that are raised.
Yeah, who's the he? That one's pretty easy.
The he, pretty sure, is Sauron.
That right. Seems, it's been, that it was capitalized. So you don't hear this if you're just listening to us, but it's he was capitalized every time we were mm-hmm. reading it. Yeah. So yeah, and that's going to be Sauron.
She is an open question, right?
That was an open question for Sam as well. Yes, mm-hmm, he was mm-hmm. greatly wondering what that could be. Yeah.
I think other questions, though, that it brings up are, well... Gollum's got this internal struggle, this tug of war, but clearly Sauron is part of the tug of war, and there's mention of we promised Sauron that if we came across the ring again we would give it to him, but then also we could take the ring for ourselves and run away and not give it to Sauron. And so it sounds like even the Gollum side of the Gollum Sméagol argument is arguing with his own self, where he's saying we could take it and run away. We could take it and follow the master's orders. We could be our own master.
Like, wait, you think he promised to give it to Sauron? I thought he promised to help Frodo.
Not explicitly. Let's see. He sees. He knows. He heard us make silly promises against his orders. Yes, we must take it. The wraiths are searching. Must take it.
Well, so, the silly promises they made, though, that was to Frodo. Though what he's saying is Sauron watched him do it.
Right, right, exactly, against his order. So yeah, in other words, yeah. The implication to me is that Sauron ordered him, like, you know, okay. if yep. you see the ring again, you bring it to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And Gollum, even if he thinks he's rejecting Sauron, he probably can't. He's not powerful enough.
Right, right.
How much of the bad Gollum versus the good Sméagol, how much of the bad Gollum is Gollum corrupted by the power of the ring, wanting the power of the ring again? and how much is Bad Gollum under the sway of the power of Sauron, acting as an inadvertent agent of Sauron, you know?
Yeah.
Or are those two things one and the same?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we can tell
yet. We don't have to answer it yet. Yeah. Just I think, keep that in mind.
And this probably also goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, where Frodo's estimating or expecting, like, how long is the promise going to hold, you know? Mm-hmm, because maybe Frodo's, he might not have directly seen it, but he's kind of aware Smeagol's having these, you know, inner demon battles going on,
right,
and stuff.
Right.
Okay, but just a little bit more on Gollum, because, I don't know, this seems like a decent enough spot to talk about him just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't really two related thoughts, but I figure we got to cover them at some point. So I can't find the notes on this. I don't know where I had read this or heard this, but I have always heard that Tolkien was part of what inspired Gollum was seeing guys in the trenches that snapped and they deserted the army and they went to live in the middle in no man's land in between the trenches, and they went so crazy that they kind of did appear like Gollum, like hunching over, you know, stealing whatever scraps of food they could, but they were just on their own because they had abandoned the army. And then it's I don't know how anybody could go that crazy to just live in the middle of a very dangerous battlefield, but apparently they did.
Wow. Yeah, that is super creepy, but I could totally envision that being an inspiration.
Yeah, but the guys in the no man's land, maybe they were an inspiration, probably were an inspiration for Gollum, but it's still how you get all this dialogue is weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, switching gears a little bit, but still talking about Gollum. This is one of the big critiques from all sorts of critics is, you know, where are the bad guys, or somebody, one of them actually even asked for an anti-hero. Like, he wanted an anti-hero in this story and everything. And it's like, well, you know, because it's sometimes Lord of the Rings gets a reputation like the good guys are all just too good of guys and stuff. But
mm-hmm.
I mean, Gollum's a pretty obvious example here where, you know, there's maybe, I guess you can say he's a bad guy, but he's really not wholly a bad guy. Though both sides here were kind of leaning towards just doing something bad. The one better side, the Smeagol side, seems at least reluctant and is actually fighting with himself and struggling. And then I feel like we've already hit this in chapter 2, but just to remember Gandalf all the way back in chapter 2 of Fellowship, like all the way back when they're at Bag End and everything, that was when they were talking about the ring and they were talking about Gollum and, you know, Frodo and Bilbo, you know, how they came to have the ring and stuff. But Gandalf was talking about these rings in general, and he had said, the quote was, "A mortal, Frodo, who keeps one of the great rings does not die, but he does not grow or obtain more life. He merely continues, at last, everything is a weariness, and then he fades." So, I mean, this is kind of a, obviously they were talking about Gollum, but not just Gollum at that point, the Ringwraiths. So, like, you know, we talked about before, when you have one of these great rings, it extends your life, but it doesn't extend the quality of your life. In fact, mm-hmm. that becomes an inverse relationship. Obviously, we've seen this with Gollum just within the two chapters here and the hints and other mentions we've had of him and before in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. So mm-hmm. Gollum's in that weariness stage. All those Ringwraiths that are now shadows have literally already faded before and long ago. And Gollum's kind of on his way, though, you know, who knows, because he hasn't had the ring for about 60 years now. So, or maybe it's 70 at this point. Anyways, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then the last thing too, another point in Gollum is, remember how we said Boromir was a good reflection of kind of just the common man person? Unfortunately, Gollum is as well.
Mm.
You know, because he was kind of just a normal hobbit to begin with, right? You know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, hobbits aren't perfect men, but, you know, they're just kind of pretty close to just short men, right?
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Pierce has this good quote here that I just want to read as well. He says, "There is, however, one other figurative representative of humanity in which we fail to recognize our own scornful and pitiful selves at our peril. The pathetic figure reflecting the readers back to themselves very uncomfortably is Gollum. Seldom, or perhaps never, in the field of human literature, has the human soul in a state of addiction to sin been portrayed with such psychological realism and spiritual brilliance? Oscar Wilde tried something similar in The Picture of Dorian Gray, but the portrait of Dorian Gray's soul is dumb and speaks only the screaming silence of its cruel and sadistic ugliness. Gollum is, however, a fully embodied image of the sin addict's soul. He brings to life with monstrous vigor the words of Christ that everyone who sins is a slave to sin, and the teaching of St. Paul about the slavery of sin. As a mirror of scorn and pity towards man, he is so powerful that we only have to visualize Gollum as a shriveled wreck of our sin-enslaved soul to shiver in horror and disgust at the vision being presented to us. It's as though the English language needs a new verb to Gollumize so that we can express the grim and graphic reality of this vision of the reality of sin. So, I know I didn't give too good a lead up to that, but what do you think of that quote?
Strong.
So, like, obviously the sin there is, you know, the ring symbolizes evil.
Right.
Evil is sin, you know, and he's addicted to the ring, even though he doesn't possess it now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it fits with what you were just saying about people feeling like there's not enough depth for the bad guys and too many good characters. Like too much contrast in the goods and bads here. And I think the quote goes to say, like, well, Gollum is not just like some pure evil thing. He's actually more relatable than any of us want to admit.
Right.
And maybe he's maybe actually the most conflicted, dynamic character in the story.
Yeah.
If we look at it that way. He's just, or maybe not the most conflicted, but perhaps on the other side of the same spectrum that Frodo is on or something like that. And therefore, yeah, super dramatic.
Yeah. All right. That was just some thoughts about Gollum that we probably needed to get through. Mm-hmm. Definitely needed to be said. Don't know how busy the rest of the chapters get for the rest of this book. So good we just cover them here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at this point, the chapter's about done. They basically move on at evening again. They're starting to travel at night pretty commonly here because that's what Gollum prefers. Plus, it's the least noticeable. And Frodo apparently was very refreshed after sleeping all day because he had a very pleasant dream, which is kind of a nice note to end on. But that's not quite the end, because one more Nazgul flies overhead. Gollum whimpers again, and this time Frodo has to threaten him with the sword to move on again. And the chapter finally ends with them drawing closer to the Black Gate, which is the entrance to Mordor.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right, guys, just me tonight. Clifford was busy with work this week, so we got to record later, but I was going to put an ending on this so I can get this episode out on time. We haven't read reviews in forever, mostly because we don't have enough reviews to keep reading them every single episode, but we have had a few since then. So here's one. This is from Ossel22, and so Ossel22 says, great insights from great hosts, 5 stars. Remember, of course, 5 stars key to all these reviews to get read. A wonderful listen, whether you're reading along with the hosts or just listening in. Patrick and Clifford are really insightful and bring a lot of really good information to the table. Thank you very much, Ossel22. Please send an email to talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com for a beer koozie, because I still have those. So, yeah, come claim it. All right. It was a good week for me. Hope it was a good week for all of you guys. I'll see you guys next week as we keep trucking through Book 4 of Lord of the Rings. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, y'all.